Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
The Economist.
It's Monday, the 25th of March, 2024. I'm Tom Lee Devlin, co-host of Money Talks, The Economist's weekly podcast on business and finance. Welcome to Editor's Picks, where you can hear three highlights from the weekly edition of The Economist read aloud. Our cover in most of the world considers why Israel looks vulnerable, even at this moment of military might. We argue that America should help it find a better strategy. In Britain, our cover looks at the country's surprising superpower, its ability to turn immigrants into citizens. Britain now has a larger share of foreign-born residents than America. For all the sound and fury of its politics over asylum, on integration, it is a model for the rest of the world. And finally, Elon Musk's Starship reached orbit on its third attempt. Though it failed to return to Earth, we argue that the rocket is a step nearer to the stars. Before you hear those stories, we have an announcement for listeners. From April 1st, Editor's Picks will be published weekdays from Monday to Thursday. Each day, we will bring you one article read aloud from the latest edition of The Economist. And now, on with today's episode. First up, the struggle for Israel's future.
There is still a narrow path out of the hellscape of Gaza. A temporary ceasefire and hostage release could cause a change of Israel's government. The rump of Hamas fighters in South Gaza could be contained or fade away. And from the rubble, talks on a two-state solution could begin, underwritten by America and its Gulf allies. It is just as likely, however, that ceasefire talks will fail. That could leave Israel locked in the bleakest trajectory of its 75-year existence, featuring endless occupation, hard-right politics and isolation. Today, many Israelis are in denial about this, but a political reckoning will come eventually. It will determine not only the fate of Palestinians, but also whether Israel thrives in the next 75 years. If you are a friend of Israel, this is a deeply uncomfortable moment. In October, it launched a justified war of self-defense against Hamas, whose terrorists had committed atrocities that threaten the idea of Israel as a land where Jews are safe. Today, Israel has destroyed perhaps half of Hamas's forces, but in important ways, its mission has failed. First, in Gaza, where its reluctance to help provide or distribute aid has led to an avoidable humanitarian catastrophe, and where the civilian toll from the war is over 20,000 and growing. The hard-right government of Benjamin Netanyahu has rejected plans for post-war Gaza to be run by either the Palestinian Authority, PA, or an international force. The likeliest outcome is a military reoccupation. If you add the West Bank, Israel could permanently hold sway over 4 to 5 million Palestinians. Israel has also failed at home. The problems go deeper than Mr. Netanyahu's dire leadership. A growing settler movement and ultra-Orthodox population have tilted politics to the right and polarized society. Before October 7th, this was visible in a struggle over judicial independence. The war has raised the stakes, and although the hard-right parties of the coalition are excluded from the war cabinet, they have compromised Israel's national interest by using incendiary rhetoric, stoking settler violence, and trying to sabotage aid and post-war planning. Israel's security establishment is capable and pragmatic, but no longer fully in charge. Israel's final failure is clumsy diplomacy. Fury at the war was inevitable, especially in the global south, but Israel has done a poor job of countering it. Lawfare, including spurious genocide allegations, is damaging its reputation. Young Americans sympathise with it less than their parents do. President Joe Biden has tried to restrain Mr. Netanyahu's government by publicly embracing it, but failed. On March 14th, Chuck Schumer, Israel's greatest ally in the Senate, decried Hamas's atrocities but said Israel's leader was lost. It is a bleak picture that is not always acknowledged in Jerusalem or Tel Aviv. Mr. Netanyahu talks of invading Rafah, Hamas's last redoubt, while the hard right fantasizes about resettling Gaza. Many mainstream Israelis are deluding themselves too. They believe the unique threats to Israel justify its ruthlessness, and that the war has helped restore deterrence. Gaza shows that if you murder Israelis, destruction beckons. Many see no partner for peace. The PA is rotten, and polls say 93% of Palestinians deny Hamas's atrocities even took place. Occupation is the least bad option, they conclude. Israelis would prefer to be popular abroad, but condemnation and anti-Semitism are a small price to pay for security. As for America, it has been angry before. The relationship is not about to rupture. If Donald Trump returns, he may once again give Israel a free pass. This seductive story is a manifesto for disaster. Consider defence. The damage to Israel's reputation could make it harder to fight on in Gaza. The long-term threat is from Iran and its proxies, including Hezbollah. Deterring this requires a military partnership with America that needs bipartisan backing, and ideally Gulf Arab support too. The economy depends on tech exports and experts with access to global markets, and rather than making Israelis safe, permanent occupation poisons politics by emboldening the hard right and breeding Palestinian radicalism. Israelis are right that they have no partner for peace today, but they are best placed to break the cycle. Israel's trajectory will intensify its ethno-nationalist politics and pose legal threats to the economy. As estrangement from the West deepens, so deterrence may weaken. Firms could be blacklisted, bosses could move high-tech businesses abroad, or if they are reversists, be arrested there. America must help Israel avoid that fate, and if it fails, it will itself pay a heavy diplomatic price. Best would be a temporary ceasefire, opening a route to two-state talks. Without this, American policy will need resetting. Mr. Biden's early embrace has failed, but so would coercion. If America tried to force Israel out of Gaza while Hamas could still regroup or curbed military support or withdrew its support at the UN, Israel's security could be in jeopardy. America should therefore use other means. It should dispense more humanitarian aid unilaterally and decline to supply weapons for an invasion of Rafah, given the lack of civilian provision. It should broaden sanctions against settlers and right-wing fanatics to show Israeli voters that America underwrites their security, but not extremism or permanent occupation. And it should continue to signal that it is keen to recognise Palestine as part of a two-state peace negotiation. America, however, can do only so much. Most Israeli wars are followed by political upheaval. Removing Mr. Netanyahu will not be easy. But when the reckoning comes, it will be huge. The war has shattered many illusions: that the Palestinians can be ignored, that the PA has any appetite for reform, that anti-Semitism is rare, that Israel can pay lip service to two states as settlements expand, and that the hard right can be tamed. The good news is that there are grounds for hope. Polls suggest that centrists in Israel command perhaps 50 to 60% of votes. Institutions like the Supreme Court are still strong, and better leaders exist. A struggle for Israel's future awaits. The battle in Gaza is just the start.
Next, a nation of immigrants.
The idea of Britain as a nation of immigration might seem counterintuitive. Its citizens voted to leave the European Union in 2016 after they were promised a tighter chokehold on inflows of people from Europe. This week, politicians in Parliament tussled over a bill that'll make it easier to ship asylum seekers to Rwanda without hearing their pleas, the latest in a string of illiberal laws designed to stop the boats. Neither does the country crow about the migrants it has. Other places have grand immigration museums. The one in New York Harbour draws millions of tourists each year. Britain's small migration museum, which was founded not by the state but by some worthies, sits in Lewisham Shopping Centre in South London, between a discount store and a shoe shop. Yet Britain now has a larger share of foreign-born residents than America. One in six of its inhabitants began life in another country. The share is rising because even as it strains to stop the boats, the Conservative government has opened the door to workers, students and selected victims of authoritarianism, such as Hong Kongers and Ukrainians. Asylum is a sideshow in terms of the numbers. Fewer than 30,000 people floated across the English Channel last year. Long-term immigration in the year to June 2023 stood at 1.2 million. More surprising still is the fact that the country is so good at assimilating immigrants. Angsty politicians gripe that Britain is letting in people from poor countries to do menial jobs, and weak students who want visas only so they can deliver pizzas. Multiculturalism has failed, they say. Too many immigrants live parallel lives in segregated neighbourhoods. Nonsense. Britain excels at getting foreigners up to speed economically, socially and culturally. It is, in this respect at least, a model for the rest of the world. In many countries, even skilled immigrants struggle to find jobs. In the EU, foreign-born adults with degrees who are not still in education have an employment rate 10 percentage points lower than natives with degrees. In Britain, the gap is a trivial 2 points, and scantily educated foreign-born people are 12 points more likely to work than their British-born peers. Even immigrants stuck in dull jobs know that their children tend to fare well in school. In England, teenagers who don't speak English as their first language are more likely to obtain good grades in maths and English in national GCSE exams than native English speakers. The PISA test run by the OECD, a rich country club, show that immigrants and their children perform badly in much of Europe. In Germany, immigrants' children scored 436 points in the latest maths test, against 495 for natives. In Britain, they did slightly better than natives. The idea that Britain is dividing into ghettos is a myth. Every ethnic group has consistently become less segregated since the census started keeping track in 1991. The foreign-born population is growing faster, not in traditional melting pots such as Birmingham and Inner London, but in staid suburbs and smallish towns. Even within those towns, foreigners don't cluster together. It's true that immigration remains the subject of furious political debate, but that's probably because the people who really dislike it are prepared to base their voting decisions on this issue alone. Britons as a whole have become more relaxed, especially since the Brexit vote. They seem unfussed by one remarkable recent development. The top political jobs in Britain, Scotland and London are all held by the children of immigrants, all of South Asian descent. The first ministers of Northern Ireland and Wales were born abroad, although Michelle O'Neill only moved north from Ireland. Britain cannot turn every migrant and every migrant's child into well-educated, productive members of society. It struggles with imported prejudices and aggressive Islamism, although that problem is sadly often homegrown. Asylum seekers don't adjust as well as others, possibly because the government crams them into hotels and prevents them from working, while it sluggishly gets round to hearing their cases. Nor is the state good at bureaucracy. The Home Office is famously incompetent. It actually retards assimilation by charging so much for naturalisation. In real terms, the cost has increased by 6 times since 2000. Moreover, Britain has a couple of advantages that other countries cannot replicate. It's a long way from a war zone, so it gets relatively few uninvited refugees, and it happens to use a language that lots of people speak a little. But two other explanations for its success are easier for others to copy. The first is Britain's flexible labour market. Compared with the rest of Europe, hiring and firing is straightforward, even for people who are employed under regular contracts. That helps immigrants find an economic foothold, which makes everything else easier. Xenophobic credentialism is weaker. One unusual thing about Britain is that immigrants with foreign qualifications have almost exactly the same employment rate as those with domestic qualifications. In most European countries, the gap is large. In Greece, It's an amazing 25 percentage points. The country's other advantage is the attitude of its people. Britons are open-minded. Just 5% told the World Value Survey that they would object to living next to an immigrant, and migrants' children report being bullied at school less often than natives' children. Britons combine an intolerance for discrimination with high expectations. Compared with other Europeans, they're keen for migrants to learn the language, obtain qualifications, adopt the culture, and become citizens. It probably helps that Britain never had guest workers. But politicians elsewhere would be wise not to predict that newcomers it has accepted will one day go home, as Angela Merkel, then Germany's Chancellor, said of refugees in 2016. Britain hasn't been an obvious country to copy recently. Its major service to the rest of Europe has been to show the costs of leaving the EU. But on integration, it's the place to beat.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
And finally, one small step for SpaceX.
The world's largest rocket has flown again. And its uncrewed test flight on March 14th, like the two previous ones, ended in rapid unscheduled disassembly, i.e. catastrophic explosions. But the upper stage of Starship, built by SpaceX, Elon Musk's rocket company, reached orbit for the first time and completed several test operations before being destroyed while re-entering Earth's atmosphere. In a defiant post on X, the social network formerly known as Twitter, Mr. Musk insisted that Starship will make life multiplanetary. Perhaps. This latest flight was at least another small step in that direction. Starship is in fact two vehicles, the Super Heavy Booster Stage, a behemoth 71 metres tall with 33 engines, and the 50-metre Starship Upper Stage, which separates from the booster at an altitude of around 70 kilometres, that's 44 miles, to proceed to orbit. The combined vehicle's first test flight in April 2023 ended roughly 4 minutes after liftoff with the self-destruction of the entire spacecraft after stage separation failed and the rocket began to corkscrew erratically. During the second test flight in November, the Starship upper stage successfully separated from the booster around 3 minutes into the flight and continued to fly for another 8 minutes, reaching an altitude of 149 kilometres. But both vehicles then suffered failures that led to their rapid, unscheduled disassembly. The third flight, once again from SpaceX's Starbase near Boca Chica in Texas, also led to the loss of both vehicles. But this time, the upper stage reached orbit at an altitude of 230 kilometres. SpaceX's aim is that both vehicles should eventually be fully reusable, flying back to Earth to land, as its Falcon 9 boosters already do. For these initial test flights, however, its plan has been for the Super Heavy booster to practice a soft splashdown at sea, slowing its descent using rocket engines before slipping beneath the waves, while the Starship swoops halfway around the Earth, re-enters the atmosphere, and makes a hard splashdown, i.e. crashes into the sea from a great height. Yet even these more limited goals have so far proved overambitious. During the test flight in November, the Super Heavy booster exploded when it attempted to reignite its engines in preparation for splashdown. This time round, it successfully completed its boost-back burn, which carried it to its intended splashdown point in the Gulf of Mexico. But when it reignited its engines for its landing burn to slow its descent velocity to almost zero, something went wrong, causing the vehicle to explode a few hundred metres above the water. The Starship, however, reached a low Earth orbit that took it across southern Africa. While in this so-called coast phase, it carried out a series of test operations, opening and closing its payload door. Starship will ultimately be able to carry as much as 150 tons of payload into orbit, transferring propellant between two onboard tanks, a warm-up for future Starship-to-Starship refueling in orbit, a requirement for missions to the Moon and Mars, and finally attempting a controlled re-entry. Onboard cameras showed the glowing pink plasma expected of a spacecraft re-entering the atmosphere. But contact was lost soon afterwards, and SpaceX announced that the vehicle had disintegrated. Whether this was because of a failure of its heat-shielding tiles, loss of control of the Starship, or some other reason, remains unclear. SpaceX has been mocked for the tendency of its test flights to end in expensive fireworks shows, but such criticism misunderstands the company's approach to rocket development. It prefers to iterate quickly and learn from failure, rather than painstakingly plan for a perfect launch, which in the rocket industry almost never happens, as the loss of the Kairos rocket launched by Space One, a Japanese firm, on its inaugural flight on March 13th, demonstrated. And a successful maiden flight is particularly unlikely for a system as complex as Starship, the largest rocket ever built, which is intended to carry humans to other worlds. In a statement before the launch, SpaceX said that each of these test flights continues to be just that, a test. They may not be occurring in a lab, the company added, but are about getting information nonetheless. This less risk-averse approach has undoubtedly enabled SpaceX to outpace its rivals in the industry. Last year, its Falcon 9 rockets flew more missions and launched more mass into orbit than did those of any other company or space agency. A more valid criticism of SpaceX is that it has cut corners in areas such as environmental protection. The Starbase facility is surrounded by the Lower Rio Grande Valley National Wildlife Refuge, which is home to an endangered species of ocelot and the piping plover, a threatened bird species, among other things. The first Starship test flight last April caused extensive damage to its launching pad, scattering debris over a wide area and prompting the Federal Aviation Authority, which regulates rocket launches, to conduct a safety review. SpaceX has since upgraded its launching pad with a flame deflector system that sprays water beneath the rocket as it takes off to reduce noise, heat, and damage. But environmentalists continue to worry about the impact of its activities. And while SpaceX may be making rapid progress by spacefaring standards, Starship development is taking longer than expected. The work is partly funded by NASA, America's space agency, and is critical to its plans to return humans to the Moon later this decade. A lunar landing by astronauts in a Starship vehicle as part of the Artemis program, once planned for 2025, has been delayed to 2026. And even that looks a stretch, given that Starship has yet to fly successfully, let alone with humans on board. Mr. Musk has said that he hopes Starship will make at least 6 more flights this year. That is just about plausible, even allowing for his infamous overconfidence. But Mr. Musk also says that before Starship carries astronauts, he wants it to have completed hundreds of uncrewed launches, carrying additional satellites for its Starlink network, which provides high-speed internet access into orbit. Starship can launch these satellites in larger batches than the Falcon 9, which has a smaller cargo capacity. The paradox of SpaceX's approach to rocket development is that it is both faster than any of its competitors and also slower than NASA needs. But whatever its speed of travel, SpaceX has just taken its next step towards the stars.
Thanks for listening to Editor's Picks and for being a subscriber to Economist Podcasts. If you want to get in touch with us, you can email podcasts@economist.com. To hear more about Starship, check out our Babbage podcast on science and technology. In 2022, we explored how the monstrous rocket could transform space travel and human connectedness on Earth. I'm Tom Lee Devlin, And in London, this is The Economist.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.